from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, European leaders are indignant after allegations that the United States bugged German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone and monitored millions of German and French telephone calls. At a summit on Friday, European Union leaders warned that such spying could harm legitimate intelligence gathering efforts. Meanwhile, The Guardian reported that the National Security Agency monitored phone conversations of 35 world leaders. That's according to documents provided by whistleblower Edward Snowden. We'll discuss the issue next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With recent revelations of the United States spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and 35 other European and world leaders, diplomatic tensions and potential serious breaches, especially in the transatlantic alliance, have occurred. France, Germany, and Spain all called in American ambassadors to protest, and denunciations were released by Italy and Belgium. What are the short and long-term effects of the spying scandal, and what can be done to rebuild trust between the United States and its allies? That is the focus for this morning's opening forum hour, and we have a panel, all of them presently in Washington, D.C. We want to welcome Annette Heuser, who is executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, one of Germany's largest private nonprofit think tanks, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to you, Michael.
And thank you for joining us. We also want to welcome Daniel Hamilton, who is Executive Director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations, Executive Director of the American Consortium on EU Studies with Johns Hopkins University, also joining us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Daniel Hamilton.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to Kurt Volker, who's also joining us from D.C. He's Executive Director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which is part of Arizona State University. And he served as U.S. Ambassador to NATO in 2008-2009. Welcome, Kurt Volker.
Thanks, Michael, and hi, Annette and Dan.
Thank you all for joining us. Annette Heuser, let me begin with you, because certainly just last Wednesday there was a phone call between President Obama and Angela Merkel, and he reassured her but reportedly didn't say much about what has occurred in the past. She sounded pretty indignant, but a lot of that indignation, it seemed, to follow Der Spiegel and concern about citizens being monitored and the like, because from a lot of perspectives, this is what everybody does, even friends and allies. And yet you call this a tsunami. Why?
Yeah, of course you can say, and we heard it all over the news this weekend from political leaders from both sides of the aisle, that everyone is spying on everybody, and it's nothing new about that. But I would argue it's something unprecedented. If you know for sure, and it seems we have clear evidence, that the U.S. Intelligence Service spied on Chancellor Merkel's phone. That's something unprecedented, and you could clearly see by Merkel's response that she was not only angry, but she was really, or she really felt the sense of betrayal from the United States. And I would make the point and ask the question, what are you getting out of the fact that you are spying on Angela Merkel's phone? You can't seriously make the point that you get secret and sensitive information out of spying on Angela Merkel's phone that helps you in the fight against terrorism. There is no way that you can do that. So this issue needs to be dealt with on the highest political level as soon as possible.
It started, though, back in 2002. We know that now. President Obama essentially allowed it to continue, but it started during the Bush administration, didn't it?
Yeah, from what we know so far, and actually there are two stories out there right now. The Wall Street Journal saying the NSA started tapping Angela Merkel's phone in 2002, but this summer when President Obama learned about the incident, he immediately stopped it. And there's another version of the story out there in Europe, reported by the Spiegel, the biggest political magazine in Europe, and the German tabloid Bild-Zeitung, saying that, in fact, President Obama learned at some point when he took office from his intelligence service, the NSA, that they are tapping Angela Merkel's phone, and his request was, I want to know exactly what this woman is thinking.
Then what do we do to rectify this, we being the United States in this case? I mean, other than an apology, which obviously may have been tendered, one would assume, by the president. Mrs. Merkel has called for yardsticks and norms and standards and says that true change, if it's going to be necessary, is going to be change and not just words.
I mean, from my point of view, there is no doubt that not only Merkel is requesting an apology from the president, and most likely she got it when she had her phone conversation with Barack Obama last week. But we also know right now that over 76% of the German public is of the opinion that the president owes the German public an apology for that. But I think you can quite frankly turn this crisis right now into an opportunity for having a long overdue serious discussion between senior leaders in Europe, Germany and the United States about the scope of intelligence work and surveillance programs that we have on both sides of the Atlantic. And what are we willing to sacrifice when it comes to personal freedoms and norms of the individuals in the fight against terrorism?
Well, Daniel Hamilton, there's been a lot of talk about going to a kind of Five Eyes arrangement the United States presently has with mainly English-speaking countries, with Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Britain, which would mean no spying at all. But I think there's presumably a great deal of work to do in addition to that, because we've, in the minds of many Europeans, violated the trust of what has been a friendship. What do you think the effect is going to be of this?
Well, this has clearly generated a crisis in confidence in the relationship. I think you're right. People say everybody's spying on everybody. The concern that the Europeans have is the scope, you know, the extent, the nature of this particular type of surveillance rather than the fact of it. And what the German and French team that's here trying to find out what's going on wants really would be, if possible, be included in this type of privileged intelligence sharing arrangements that the U.S. has in place with other countries like Britain, Canada, and so on. I think, but and that is points to this other deeper issue, which is this type of issue intrudes into a whole set of very concrete U.S.-European, foreign policy challenges. And unless we get some alignment on this issue, it will impinge on a number of other concrete issues. For instance, what is the right balance between security and liberty and democratic societies? Since September 11th, we've been having debate in the United States. I don't know anyone who says we've gotten this exactly right, and the debate is continuing. I would argue most European democracies, if they're honest, probably don't think they get their balance right either. I mean, it's an ongoing discussion for a democracy. But if we don't get it somehow aligned across the Atlantic, it impinges on concrete issues. For instance, the U.S. and Europe have an agreement on financial data transactions called SWIFT, in which there's access to those financial data if there's some suspicion of some link to terrorist funding. That if the confidence goes, then that type of agreement will go. We have agreements on passenger name recognition and a number of fairly contentious issues over the past number of years, but we've gotten agreement on them despite these different problems. These will all be then damaged, and our ability then to wage a campaign against terrorism will be affected. I think the other big issue looming is that the U.S. and the EU have started a negotiation on a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, you know, a very big, ambitious agreement that will have at its heart how to align some regulatory differences across the Atlantic. So if we cannot come to terms on some core balance and principles on data protection, on surveillance, these types of things, that type of negotiation would be in jeopardy because the European Parliament will never approve an agreement of this kind in the trade area if it feels that these other issues haven't been resolved.
Well, we should mention that Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande of France have sent high-level team to D.C., as I think you alluded to negotiate new rules. But the TTIP, the Transatlantic Treaty and Investment Partnership, will not be ratified at this point because of this scandal. I believe that's what I'm inferring from what you're saying, and that this really could hurt and seriously damage cooperation in terms of terrorism and fighting terrorism.
Well, these are early days. This negotiation has just barely gotten started, so it's not like it's waiting for ratification. So there's time here. My point is that our discussions on intelligence are not going to be part of a negotiation on this trade agreement. but they will be in parallel. There is a U.S.-EU group that's been set up to address these issues. It has to be taken seriously, and the timeline for resolution of that would have to be in line with these other negotiations if we would head to any ratification debate. But this is not something imminent. It would be over the next year and a half at most. So I do think there's time to resolve this, and it does seem the U.S. and the Europeans are trying to figure out. It'll come down to not only concrete sort of agreements on within the intelligence community itself, but on this broader issue of data protection, privacy rights between, the European Union, which has a somewhat different set of principles guiding that, and the United States. And that's, each of us are having our own debate on that, but we have to have a transatlantic discussion on how at least to align or recognize each other's differences so they don't get in the way of our cooperation.
Well, let me go to Kurt Volker, if I may, Executive Director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership. And Kurt Volker, aren't we talking here also about leverage the United States might have with Europe, or Secretary Kerry's leverage particularly?
I think it's a distraction is maybe the way to think of it. So, we don't really leverage our allies either. I mean, we try to work out what we can agree on and do together. And this issue is going to suck up all the oxygen for a while. That we're going to end up, when we get together, we're going to talk about this and try to figure out what we say and do about this, as opposed to all the other things that we could and should be talking about, like what do we do about Syria, or what do we do about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as Dan was saying. So I think it's a distraction as far as that goes.
And how is this going to affect NATO, if at all?
Well, I think in the short term, it's going to affect everything because there will be this attitude, as you heard from Annette, I think quite rightly, an upset in the publics, maybe even a genuine upset from Chancellor Merkel herself, feeling a little bit violated. You know, these are my communications. Why are you doing this? And that will infect every discussion. There'll be a standoffishness and an unhappiness. In the long run, though, I think that the same issues that are always there are still there. We share the same values as societies in terms of freedom, democracy, rule of law, human rights. We view the world in much the same way, the threats and the challenges that are out there. We want to work together to deal with those things. And those underlying fundamentals are still in place and will still be in place. But we're going to have a bumpy period for a while we get this behind us.
But you wonder, in democracies, what the attitude is going to be toward the United States when citizens themselves were being spied upon.
Sure. No, that's and here, let's come back to the actual facts of the scandal as it has come up, because I think it's worth mentioning some of these. First off, publics are genuinely upset, and there's no doubt about that. That being said, it is an upset that is perhaps a little bit ill-informed. European governments, whether it's France or Germany or the UK, have excellent intelligence services. They really do a tremendous job. They are quite capable of doing all the same sorts of things that we're talking about here.
But forgive me, the French foreign minister said he was jealous, or they were jealous because their intelligence is not as good as ours.
Actually, they have very good intelligence services. Just leave it at that. I don't want to make comparisons, but they're quite good. And secondly, we share a lot of information with each other on a day-to-day basis, which is obtained from all these sorts of methods that we're talking about, and they know that. So there's a high degree to which European governments are well aware and doing many of the same things that the United States has been doing, and we actually cooperate on this. Now, Annette made a very good point that I want to come back to, which I think is the way I would think about it. I don't see this really as an issue of trust or an issue of, does this somehow make us not allies, or does this somehow make the U.S. suspicious of Germany or vice versa? No, that should not be the case. We're all doing these things. We're all grown-ups. We've all been countries for ages, and this is what countries do. But the thing that is relevant is it worth it? What do we get out of listening to Angela Merkel's unclassified phone calls on her mobile device that we couldn't get from asking her diplomatic advisor what's going on? So I think maybe it ought to be thought of more as a question of where are we placing our priorities and how are we addressing that. We ought to be focused more squarely on Iran and China and Russia, figuring out what they're doing and learning as much as we can about that, rather than spending the effort that it would take to do these things in allies.
Well, I'm assuming that you would get, presumably, or you would, whoever was behind this would assume they would get some kind of trade or economic advantage.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it really works that way. You know, when you're dealing with democratic countries that respond to popular concerns, that are dealing with parliaments, that are dealing in a very public way with issues, just as we do, just as the UK does or others, I'm not sure that we actually do get a lot out of that. And we do have the relationships right up to the top level. I mean, Chancellor Merkel and President Obama talk on the phone. So is there really a whole lot more that you get that's valuable out of spying on allies? Whereas, if you look at Russia or China or Iran, they're not democracies. They conceal their motives. They are trying to accomplish very different things in the world than we and our allies are interested in and concerned about. That does strike me as a much higher priority.
And do you think that some of this European response may be manufactured or over-dramatized?
Well, again, democratic societies, you know, how does the math work out? Publics are upset. Leaders, therefore, have to show that they are upset, too, in order to be in tune with their publics. And so there is a degree to which it's genuine, as Annette said. I think in Chancellor Merkel, she feels it genuinely. But I also think there's a degree to which the establishments need to show that they are upset for public consumption.
Well, let me bring our listeners into this. In fact, we'd like to hear from you, your thoughts and any questions or comments you might have. And you can join us now at our toll-free number. You're invited to do so, whether you're listening on radio, Internet, or a Sirius satellite. We welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments that you might have or anything you want to bring into the conversation onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm wondering also, Annette Heuser, about an article which you might have seen Henry Farrell and Martha Finneman did in Foreign Affairs, where they said that sort of makes it a whole different case in terms of American hypocrisy. They argue, I suppose, to some extent, that the United States doesn't have as much space for hypocrisy as a result of this.
Yeah, I think clearly what we see right now is that that the closest ally of the United States, the Europeans, have serious question marks about the relationship and about how much we can trust our American allies. I mean, I was on the phone over the weekend with many people also in senior government positions in Berlin, and they were saying, we are seriously questioning if we can trust the Americans at all with anything right now, what they are telling us. And I've never witnessed such a situation in the 20 years that I'm dealing with transatlantic relations. And I think this administration and the policymakers in Washington, D.C. need to realize that this is a serious scandal, and it can affect the weight and the trust and the power of bringing other nations to the table that the U.S. has executed successfully in the last decades. So the U.S. are losing their convening power on the international scene with this scandal right now, quite clearly. And we witnessed that first and foremost in the transatlantic relationship, but also if you take a look how the scandal played out in regions like Latin America with the Mexicans and the Brazilians. These countries had also doubts about the seriousness of the U.S. engagement in their region, in their countries. And these doubts have been reconfirmed to a certain extent with the NSA scandal in Brazil and Mexico.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. It's certainly not limited to Europe by any stretch because of Mexico and Brazil, and we're talking about 35 countries. But when I bring up that article in Foreign Affairs, I do so largely because Mrs. Merkel was a lot less critical when the NASA news broke initially until it was her own phone.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it has to do with the fact that it was first and foremost Merkel's phone, because to a certain extent, we know that the NSA is also spying on European and on German citizens. And we have to have an open debate among our intelligence community right now on both sides of the Atlantic. What should be the scope of the spying? But again, President Obama is somebody who likes to talk about red lines, and tapping the phone of Angela Merkel, the leader of Germany, clearly a democratic country, one of the closest allies of the United States, is clearly crossing a red line here.
And let me just ask you, Kurt Volker, about what really can be done to move forward on this. I mean, how can we turn this thing around at this point, other than establishing new rules or doing the sort of thing like the Five Eyes arrangement that I alluded to earlier?
I think a lot of frank talk, both from European leaders and from the U.S. I think what we're hearing about the concern and the outrage is important to hear, to have that be expressed. I also think some acknowledgement that we do live in a world where spying goes on all the time would be important to hear from European leaders. I think on the American side, we need to have some candor about what was actually done so that no one's wondering, well, what else is there and what else is there? But we have some candor about that. And then, as Annette and others have said, some rules of the road is probably what's going to be called for in order to move beyond. I don't think that we lose a whole lot by saying that, we're not going to be spying on the leaders of our allies. I don't think there's any harm in making that commitment, so why not make it and say it? And then I also think one of the things we need to have out there as well as a reminder about the world we live in is that just because the U.S. is or isn't listening on someone's cell phone doesn't mean that a whole lot of other people aren't. When I was in government, you knew that your email, that your cell phone, that any other wirelessly connected device that you have is not secure, and that you just take it for granted that someone is trying to get into that and spy on that. And that's a reality that every government, every foreign leader lives in. And so the real issue is, what are the purposes of that? Is it to advance human freedom, human rights, security in the world, or is it to advance some national interest that's against someone else or that is destructive of human rights or democracy or security?
And let me, Daniel Hamilton, I know you have to leave because actually you're going to be hosting the Foreign Affairs Committee of the EU Parliament and have to leave to do that. But let me just get some wisdom from you on if the United States can move forward and try to patch up and build some bridges here. Who's going to be policing, and not only who's going to be policing in terms of any rules that might be worked out, but the executive power, because it was President Obama's decision to continue this?
Well, I think obviously there are congressional oversight committees, and there's a internal process of review, as we know, which is under some debate about how constitutional that is or effective. So that we do have our processes. I mean, we're having a debate in the United States about the extent and reach of these surveillance activities. I think the European media has, frankly, not captured much of that, that there is a real debate in the United States about, as I said, this balance between security and liberty. It's been going on, clearly, since September 11, but even, it's an age-old dilemma. And I would argue we don't have that right. I think most democracies don't, get it right all the time. And that's just part of what we're going to have to do. In terms of the specifics with Europeans, I think I would share what Kurt just said, that we're going to have to, is this going to take a lot of political oxygen out of our conversation with the Europeans on a whole range of other issues? So in that, that's problematic because it will take away from our ability to work together on seemingly unrelated topics, at least for a period. So trying to get this behind us, having some arrangements within the intelligence community, those are going to be classified, we won't know what those are, will be an important first step, whether it's no spy or simply a new way of intelligence sharing that's good for all is one point. As I said, there is a difference in the basic legal framework for data protection and privacy in the European Union and in the United States. And if we're going to work together on a whole range of issues that also affect our economies, opening up trade and investment, we're going to have to figure out a way where we can align those basic principles.
Daniel Hamilton, many thanks for joining us. Good luck with the Foreign Affairs Committee of the EU Parliament, and appreciate your being with us. Daniel Hamilton, again, is Executive Director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations and Executive Director of the American Consortium on EU Studies at Johns Hopkins University. We'll continue, and we'll hear from you, our listeners. Annette Heuser is with us, Kurt Volker, and you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're talking about the NASA spying scandal this hour and asking the question, can the United States rebuild trust with its allies? European leaders are indignant after allegations that the U.S. bugged German Chancellor Angela Merkel's phone and monitored millions of German and French telephone calls. And in fact, looking at a press release here that says the agency also spied on more than 60 million phone calls in Spain in 1 month alone, just to give you some idea of how extensive this was. And at a summit on Friday, European Union leaders warned that such spying could harm legitimate intelligence gathering efforts. Meanwhile, The Guardian has reported that the National Security Agency monitored the phone conversations of 35 world leaders. That's according to documents provided by whistleblower Edward Snowden. We spoke earlier with Daniel Hamilton from Johns Hopkins, director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations and executive director of the American Consortium on AU Studies. And with us for the rest of the hour, Annette Heuser, who is executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, one of Germany's largest private nonprofit think tanks, and Kurt Volker, who is executive director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which is part of Arizona State University and served as ambassador from the United States to NATO in 2008-2009. We're going to go to your calls. First, let me go to some web comments and emails, and you can post on our web at kqed.org/forum. Or you can go to you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our Facebook page. Beth writes, I've been reading French, German, British newspapers, and I get a whole new view of just how livid German Chancellor Angela Merkel is. Remember, these are supposed to be our close allies, and the phone was her personal phone. Good God, who's running NASA? And do any of them even care about the damage they are doing to this country? Another listener, John, writes, the United States is continuing to devolve into the laughingstock of the free world. We literally do the exact opposite of everything we run around the world preaching. There's no good way out of this NASA predicament, NSA predicament. If Obama knew about Merkel's phone tapping, then he's both a liar and a supreme hypocrite based on his platform of transparency and change from the Bush years of foreign policy. Or if he didn't know, then what else doesn't he know that the NSA is doing? Clearly, we live in a dangerous world that we have created and cloak and dagger is needed, but tapping an allied leader's cell phone? Another listener, Alex, writes, is this really unexpected? To what extent would she roll our eyes and assume that everybody spies on everybody? And is the shock indeed only for public consumption? Ken writes on our Facebook page, rebuilding trust starts with telling the truth and holding those accountable who lie to Congress and the people. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper and General Keith Alexander should be brought up on perjury charges. Keith Alexander is the director of NSA. And John writes, the NSA is spying on everyone because they can, and the more information they gather, the more their contractors are paid. Eisenhower warned us. A couple of questions from a listener named Mike via email. He says, since Bush initiated phone data gathering in 2002, most of the media fails to differentiate between computer-generated mass phone log gathering to see possible terrorist communication patterns and real tapping and listening in on specific conversations. What really does happen between our friendly allies, tapping or gathering of phone logs? Domestically, we understand that once a pattern is found, the FISA judge has to approve actual tapping. Can either of our guests, Kurt Volker or Annette Heuser, sure, perhaps respond to that?
Yeah, I'd be happy, especially on the last question. I think that it was something I was thinking about as well as you were describing the situation in Spain. It's both, actually, as far as I understand it, that there is a collection of the kind of metadata that people talked about in the NSA scandal here in the U.S., where you're getting a phone number and a length of time and the phone number they connected to. And like a number like 60 million, such as it used in Spain in a one-month period, clearly no one can be listening to 60 million conversations. What you're doing is you're getting the record of 60 million phone calls, which then can be analyzed by a computer to see whether there are patterns that emerge that then warrant further investigation. So that's one thing. That's what we've heard in the U.S., and I'm sure that's what these very big numbers that you're talking about with Spain or other countries are referring to in Europe. In addition to that, then you have the specific listening in on something such as the chancellor's cell phone in Germany, if in fact that's the case. And again, I haven't seen that it's confirmed by the administration that that's the case, but let's assume that it is. That would be listening in specifically on individual conversations. As we talked about earlier, the question is whether it's really worth it and do you get anything out of that. But the fact of listening in on the specifics would be to get the content of those conversations.
Well, I want to go to our callers, but first let me go back to you, Annette Heuser, because I'm looking at a question from a listener who says, making the recent NSA activity public required that Merkel respond forcefully. Did she do so mainly to appease German indignation, or was she actually caught by surprise?
I think Merkel really wasn't caught by surprise in the last days when she was probably presented hard evidence that the NSA was tapping her phone, because don't forget, the scandal is around and these allegations are around right now for 5 months. They broke this summer, actually before President Obama visited Berlin. And we know that at this point, the two leaders had already an off-the-record debate about the NSA spying on Germans and most likely on the German government. But what I would stress here is that Angela Merkel is well well-known, very rational and calm political leader. So she does nothing in a kind of, you know, erratic mode. But for her to come out that strong in public, saying that spying on your friends is a no-go and it's not acceptable, that's something very unique. And everybody who knows Angela Merkel as a political leader clearly knew at this point that the allegations must be very serious.
Well, the EU summit put out a statement from Brussels saying this lack of trust, again, could prejudice intelligence gathering cooperation. So there seems to be, certainly in the short term, a lot at stake here. You may want to comment on what you think is at stake, but also on what you think should be done. That's what we'd like to hear from you and hear your questions or comments. And let me go to your calls. We go first to Frank, who joins us from up north. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I'm hearing a lot of talk about spying on our allies and why we should or shouldn't do that. But I'd like to point out that we're also economic competitors with Germany, France, China, Japan. And one of the questions I would have, especially about specific targeted listening instead of metadata, is how much of that is industrial? How are we really listening in to try and find an advantage for Boeing? I know that Boeing just recently lost a huge contract with Japan, I think it was, who had always bought Boeing. Now they're going to Airbus. I know that our embassies are really there to promote American business, but what I would be concerned about is where does this information from listening into governments who are helping their own companies, where does that go? Does it go to Ford? Does it go to Boeing? Does it go to some arms manufacturer in the United States? That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, I think it's an important question, and thank you for it, Frank. Kurt Volker, we can speculate on that, but I think a great deal of it is about trade and industry and commerce.
Well, but I would draw a big distinction here. Other countries, and I can think of allied countries spying on the U.S., do so often for economic reasons or economic advantage. I can think of a few cases.
Well, we yell a lot about China, don't we?
Well, and China not being an ally, China is the number one spy country in the world at this point in terms of what they are trying to acquire. And really, it's intellectual property information that they can exploit or things like business strategies that they can exploit as well, and then reverse engineer into their own companies. Certainly, also technology is an issue that many countries have tried to acquire from the United States. The difference, though, is the United States does not have a lot of large state-owned or state-related companies where we are gathering information as a government and providing it directly to an industry. So we actually do far, far less in the area of economic intelligence than many other countries do. And
yeah,
there's no mechanism,
issue.
I should add, too. There's
yeah,
no
you want to comment on that, Heiser?
Yeah, thank you, Frank, for bringing up the issue of industrial spying, because actually, if I should make a prediction today, this is the next chapter that will come up after the NSA scandal is hopefully solved on the highest political level on the issue if you can tap foreign leaders' mobile phone, because I would expect there is certainly a lot of dust under the rock that we will discover in the next months and years to come. And yes, Frank, you're right. Europeans and Americans are competitors. But first and foremost, I would make the case that we are allies when it comes to trade and the economic relationship in the world. And Dan Hamilton brought it up earlier. Right now, Europeans and Americans started this mega free trade agreement, the so-called TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement negotiations this summer, which will create, as we estimated, in the U.S. alone, once this is implemented, over 740,000 new jobs. So we are talking about the entire workforce that we would add of New Hampshire or West Virginia here. So this is a mega deal. And I think at this point we can't afford, as Kurt Volker put it, that this NSA scandal is taking all the oxygen out of these very important negotiations.
And I'll bring another caller on, and that's you, Colin. Good morning. You're on the air.
Whether the outrage over the wiretapping of Chancellor Merkel's phone is genuine or not, aren't there real differences between the U.S. and Germany on who represents a threat to us? Merkel declined to support the military action against Libya. That judgment now seems prescient, given the shambles that the country has turned into. Germany also, before Schroeder, opposed the invasion of Iraq. Their intelligence had been better than ours since they had identified Curveball, the Iraqi defector whose allegations that Colin Powell had relied upon in his UN speech as a fraud. Maybe instead of listening to the German government through wiretapping, we should actually listen to their point of view.
That Heuser?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, over years right now, we have seen that Germany and the U.S. are not always in line, or most of the time not in line, when it comes to questions of war and peace and the issues of military intervention. So far, the Iraq war and the differences that we had over military intervention or not between Germany and the U.S. presented the lowest point in the transatlantic relationship. And we have seen that over the question of if we should establish a no-fly zone over Libya and Germany obtained its vote in the United Nations, that this caused some, you know, question marks on this side of the Atlantic here in Washington, D.C. And over the years, the U.S. has become more and more suspicious about this kind of new Germany under the leadership of Angela Merkel. The question was, and Kurt Volker knows this as much as I do here in town, what does Germany really want and what does Germany stand for? And is Germany really a reliable partner when it comes to any kind of military engagement in the world? And obviously, this German government that we have right now in Berlin and we will have after the election right now has no appetite anymore for any kind of military actions in the world. And this is, of course, major issues for the transatlantic relationship.
Yeah, I think the caller makes an excellent point. I think that Germany's unwillingness to go along in Iraq and also in Libya may indeed have prefigured this decision to find out what information they could from the private phone of Chancellor Merkel. In fact,
yeah.
I think, David, you have a comment right on point here. Go ahead, David.
Well, yeah, it's basically identical to that. And I'm thinking back, 1960, John F. Kennedy was left out of the loop of the Bay of Pigs. And whether or not, if I understand right, a few minutes ago you said that this bugging of her was begun in 2002.
That's right.
And it's continued. So in Bay of Pigs, John F. Kennedy comes to power, and he didn't know about the planning for Bay of Pigs until the last moment. And then he's politically humiliated. So is this a similar Bay of Pigs strategy by the people that that killed Kennedy?
What do you think, Kurt Volker?
I'd say absolutely not. I understand the case with Kennedy, but we're also talking a matter of months. I mean, President Obama's been in for 5 years, and he's been briefed on this. And if he has not been aware of the programs of spying on leaders, I mean, he's the principal recipient of intelligence information gathered at that highest level. That's very compartmentalized, very restricted as to who might know about it or see it, and it's all aimed at providing the information to the president. So I can't give any credibility at all to the idea that he was unaware of this or was not benefiting and actually listening, you know, taking advantage of that intelligence information. I also want to point out that 2002 date that's been mentioned a couple times. I think the reason that that's there is because that's when we were able to do it. Countries have been spying on each other for millennia, and just a question of what are the means that countries have at their disposal. I have no doubt that a generation prior to ours, you know, Eisenhower or others, were getting information on all manner from both allies and enemies alike that they were processing, but the means were very different because our capabilities were very different as cell phones became in greater use, and then the ability to decode even cell phone encryption got further advanced, and the ability to handle mass quantities of data got further advanced. The NSA has just kept up with that, and it begs the question, as Annette and Dan Hamilton earlier said, so what do we do now? What's the right way for intelligence agencies to behave, given that we have all this capability? Where should we put our resources, and where should we put our red lines?
Well, again, you're welcome to join us. In fact, I'm reading a web comment. Our website's kqed.org/forum. Listener writes, every official U.S. spokesman I've heard comment on this has offered the defense that everyone else is doing it. Though it's tempting to respond with a standard parental comment, if everyone else jumped off a cliff, would you? And while it's true that all governments do more spying than they admit, I do not believe that other European governments have been tapping the United States president's phone. In my opinion, what the U.S. has done is inexcusable, but not in the least surprising. And by the way, question for you, our listeners, are you concerned about the news that the United States is spying on its allies, or do you simply accept the fact that everybody else is doing it and everybody spies on everybody else? And I should also mention here that Max Boot, who is a war historian whom we featured on Forum a number of times, wrote in commentary, and I'm quoting him, "Much of their anger," he's talking about world leaders, "is faked for public consumption. The only outrage is that anyone is outraged." Let me go to another caller here, and we welcome Peter. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for this discussion. I'd like to bring up a useful catchphrase that could help clarify our general modes of operation and choices at every level of society, literally from personal relationships to global public policy. And that is that we should lean pretty hard in the direction of overt intelligence, preferred over covert intelligence. By definition, overt intelligence has a tremendous advantage of involving a broader community, whether it's your spouse or partner or the public. And this almost automatically guarantees a more efficient information gathering process.
Well, you raise an interesting point here, and let me just get some response from both Kurt Volker and Annette Heuser. I think when you mentioned, Kurt Volker, that this started in 2002, because I think you were implying the technology was there, we can say to a great extent that covert intelligence linked to technology has become much more efficient, just like drones have become more efficient than boots on the ground.
I think that's exactly right. Intelligence collection has been around since there have been people. And the idea is just, how do you organize that? What do you do? And we've just gotten very, very good at intelligence collection because of the technologies now available. Your caller makes a point about overt versus covert, which I just wanted to come back to as well. That echoes kind of what I was saying, that we, in democratic societies, a lot of the information is available publicly anyway. And the added value of getting a cell phone conversation is really not that great. In countries that are less open, that are not democratic, where governments are not responsive to their publics in the way that they behave, that's where I think you're going to find a lot more value in direct intelligence collection.
Well, and here's a listener, Philip Annette Heuser, who writes, "I'm pleased that NSA spying, Angela Merkel's cell phone, has come to light because it's wrong to spy upon allies' phones, which it clearly is. It's not so much more obvious how wrong to perform surveillance upon U.S. citizens' telecommunications, email and metadata, so-called, and social media. What we need is ironclad protections for U.S. citizens' civil rights. This will protect Merkel's privacy as well."
Yeah, I absolutely agree here. As we already discussed, it's time right now to have a serious debate, not only among the political leaders, about probably a no-spy agreement that Angela Merkel proposed last weekend between Germany and the U.S. and that hopefully could be concluded. That's her plan by the end of the year. But also, I think more and more the citizens in Europe and in the U.S., as you have seen over the weekend, when there were a couple of hundred protesters here in Washington on the streets protesting against the spy activities of the NSA, about what we are willing to accept as citizens when it comes to surveillance and intelligence work.
I want to read a few more emails and web comments. Here's a listener who writes, "NSA gathers data from everyone, yet still missed on a number of attacks, Boston, Benghazi attacks abroad, etc. Gathering data does not seem to be a problem. Maybe making use of it is a different matter. They keep piling on data after data, and what about making sense of it all?" And then he writes, "Are we actually to believe that neither of those countries or other allies, in fact all countries, do not spy on each other, friends and foes? Is Merkel denying or just not addressing any possible or probable spying on the U.S.? Does no other country listen in on presidential or on down phone conversations?" And Ben writes, "What's our guarantee that a few corrupt officials in the NSA are not brokering information collected from European wiretapping to third parties who may not share U.S. interests? Obama is not the one personally screening the German chancellor's calls." And Carol writes on Facebook, "The years of Republican attacks have created a situation where Democrats are so busy swatting at birthers and Benghazi and defund and food stamps and voting rights sabotagers are and so many hornet-like attacks from the far right that we cannot sincerely deal with things that need fixing, like the website problems of the ACA to the totalitarian direction of the NSA. Not only are valuable hearings taken up with nuisance issues, but the very will of Democrats to look at Obama policy has been compromised. Can we even criticize the president and policy without seemingly being aligned with assault rifle-toting zealots?" Well, you know, I can't help thinking, Kurt Volker, with all the thoughts that are coming in from listeners, and many of them quite salient, that we really have to get our own house in order here in terms of checks and balances, don't we?
I fully agree with that. And you mentioned earlier drones. We could talk about privacy versus security and intelligence collection. We could talk about the role of government versus the role of society, and where should the balance of effort be. There's a whole lot of things, and frankly, our finances and our budgets as well, a whole lot of things that we are just not leading by example on, to put it mildly. And that is something that I think we need to sort out. We've been faced with a number of changes over the last 20 or 30 years. Really, you can date it to the advent of the Internet, where technology has advanced phenomenally. The ability to do things, whether it's to monitor individual behavior on the Internet or monitor phone calls, or therefore to collect intelligence, has created a whole set of things that we could not have done 20 or 30 years ago, and therefore didn't make any calculated value judgments about what should we do. And there, I think there really is scope for a lot of getting our own house in order, so that we've thought through both how we use our capacities, what our respective roles are, what our values and our goals, and then what are the examples we want to set, and then try to see those reflected in a world that we would be comfortable living in.
Reading a Facebook comment from a listener who says, political leaders must know that their conversations are subject to espionage just as surely as they know that they are seeking to discover intelligence on their allies and enemies. The politicians in private must be shrugging their shoulders while voicing required outrage to placate their populace. This too shall pass, and the impact will be minimal when the Europeans weigh being an ally of the U.S. versus being an ally of Russia or China. Well, it leads me right to the question, and if I may begin with you on this, Annette Heiser, let's look ahead. What's likely to happen next?
I think the best way out of this is right now to bring the top intelligence people from both sides of the Atlantic together and have a serious conversation about what happened and how much we, the Europeans, are willing to allow the U.S. intelligence services access to our information in the future. What should be the scope of U.S. surveillance in Europe in the next years to come? Also to the earlier comments, I think there's no doubt, and nobody would deny it in Europe, that the German intelligence services, as well as the other European intelligence services, are collecting information in the U.S. as much collecting information in China and Russia. But I was always told by intelligence people, if by accident they are tapping the phone conversations of high-level officials, also the political leaders of a friendly country, the unwritten rule is to put it aside. And I think this should be the rule that should apply in the future here in the U.S. as well.
Well, leading intelligence officers are coming to the nation's capital, apparently, to talk about this. That's already fait accompli. What do you think is going to come out of it, Kurt Volker?
Well, I think Dan Hamilton alluded to this earlier. You need some kind of agreement, preferably an agreement that has a public element and a private element, so that you can say to public, here's what we've done, and you have some private things that may go a little bit more clear and into detail so that everyone understands what we're doing and what we're not doing. One thing that I think we have to be careful against, though, and I picked this up from one of either the caller's comments or an email comment, but I just wanted to come back to it, is let's not discredit the whole idea of collecting intelligence. Other governments, all governments around the world are out there busily collecting intelligence to advance whatever their interests are, and we need to be doing the same thing. I would hate to be in a situation where our government is the only one that's flying blind. The question then becomes one of judgment. When do you use your resources? Where are the red lines? How do you deal with allies as opposed to countries that have different values and different interests and are acting against you? There is certainly scope for different ways of treating allies, ways of showing them more trust and respect, the sort of things that Annette has been talking about earlier. But let's not discredit the whole idea of intelligence collection, because we frankly depend on it.
Well, at this point, what's the risk to intelligence, particularly in terms of anti-terrorism or counterterrorism activity?
I think the risk is that we keep seeing changes in behavior of terrorists or others as they learn more from the leaks of Edward Snowden and things like that, what the U.S. is capable of and what we're doing. It drives them to find other different ways of communicating and carrying out their activities that may be harder to track. And so I think we are seeing behavior adjusted by criminals and terrorists and others. And that's where I think it's going to be harder for us. We're going to have to keep innovating to figure out how we can stay on top of those things.
Well, I've got an interesting question here about Snowden himself. Annette Heiser, perhaps you can shed some light on this. A listener wants to know how he is regarded in other countries, hero or traitor. What's the main consensus you get, for example, from Germany?
It's interesting. I mean, until recently, the overall German public opinion about Snowden was that he's a traitor. And of course, there's no way that we should even think about giving him asylum in Germany, which was part of the debate as well. But right now, under the current NSA scandal that reached its peak last week, the German public is thinking more in the lines of, you know, actually what he did was quite courageous, and it helped us a big deal to discover what was going on in Berlin when it comes to the NSA activities and tapping Merkel's phone.
Well, we'll leave it there, and I want to thank you, Annette Heiser, for joining us this hour of Forum. Annette Heiser, again, is Executive Director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, one of Germany's largest private nonprofit think tanks. She joined us from the nation's capital. Appreciate your being with us this morning. Want to extend thanks also to Kurt Volker, who is with us from Washington as well, Executive Director of the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which is part of Arizona State University. And Kurt Volker served as U.S. Ambassador to NATO in 2008-2009. Thanks also to Daniel Hamilton, who is with us for the first half hour, Executive Director of the Center for Transatlantic Relations and Executive Director of the American Consortium on EU Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, or our Facebook page. And another hour of Forum coming up. We're actually going to find out all about Asian American graphic comics with one of the best known, actually nominated twice for National Book Award practitioners, and also find out about sound being restored with a MacArthur Genius Award winner who is restoring sound through physics and photography and all kinds of new and innovative means. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.